Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. It was a week of reflection and remembrance of Senator John McCain, who died Saturday from brain cancer. Former Vice President Joe Biden delivered an emotional tribute during Thursday's memorial service in Phoenix.
To paraphrase Shakespeare, we shall not see his like again.
Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum made history as Florida's first African-American nominee for governor, an unexpected victor who upended the Sunshine State's Democratic establishment.
Right here in the state of Florida tonight, we have shown the rest of the country that we can be the David in the situation where there's a Goliath.
An inspiring victory and a clear pandering to the David demographic. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kimberly Atkins, Nancy Ankrum, and On Point's Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online. How are this week's primary results shaping this fall's general election? President Trump warns his achievements will be overturned quickly and violently if Republicans were to lose Congress in the midterms. What do you make of that? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Happy to mark this is our inaugural broadcast of Folkenflik Fridays from New York City. Joining me now from Washington is Kimberly Atkins, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Herald. Kimberly, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, David.
And with us from Miami, Florida, is Nancy Ankrum, editorial page editor for the Miami Herald. Nancy Ankrum, I think this is your first time with the show. Welcome to On Point.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Kimberly, and Nancy.
Nancy, let's start with you. There were a couple of pretty major primaries this week in Arizona, but also in your home state of Florida. Tell us about what happened there on both sides of the aisle, particularly, I guess, you know, I guess the leading item would have been the governor's race, but you tell me.
Absolutely. And as the headline of our postmortem editorial said, well, that was a surprise, wasn't it? Uh-huh. Andrew Gillum did win the Democratic gubernatorial primary, besting several other more established, more traditional candidates that had received the support, was tacitly receiving the support of the state Democratic Party. And he didn't have the money that they had. They were all elected officials, so it's not as if he is an outsider or an insurgent.
Right. He's the mayor of Tallahassee, the state capital there in Florida. So he's not utterly an unknown.
No, absolutely not. The word that so many people use is he has charisma. However, he has a lot more than that. He has a lot of smarts when it comes to governance. And he did not, though he had a great infusion of money from Tom Steyer and from George Soros, he was the only millionaire not in the race, the only person really not able to self-fund his campaign. He played a great ground game. He played a great game on social media, and he eked out a win over Gwen Graham, who was the presumed winner of the Democratic primary. She is a former lawmaker from Congress. From North Florida. She is the daughter of a still popular former governor, Bob Graham, and Senator Bob Graham. And it looked like it was hers to lose, which mm-hmm. she did.
Which she managed to do. My recollection was Gillum won with about 24% of the vote, and therefore this
yes.
was a split primary in some ways, but nonetheless that he had on the ground quietly with some help from outside money from, as you said, billionaires Tom Steyer and George Soros, nonetheless had quietly built up a significant support there. Tell us a little bit about the Republican nominee, a congressman named Ron DeSantis.
Yes, Ron DeSantis was a off the radar, again, another congressional lawmaker. And Donald Trump really liked how he liked his style on Fox, and more important, liked the fact that DeSantis was a solid, solid supporter of President Trump. Mm-hmm. And so he gave him a boost in December, which really sent his numbers soaring. And then in June, he gave him a solid endorsement. DeSantis beat Adam Putnam, the agricultural secretary of Florida currently, and really considered the Republican boy wonder who was destined to be governor. Well, not in 2018. He comes from a generations old Central Florida family, agriculture, farming. He was elected to Congress at age 22. And became agricultural secretary under Governor Scott, who was
highly expected to run away with this and essentially was run over by DeSantis once he had the Trump turbocharge, I imagine.
Absolutely, absolutely. Putnam also shot himself in the foot a couple of times. It might have worked had DeSantis not jumped into this race. However, Adam Putnam declared himself a proud sellout to the NRA. Well, that may have played to his base in the Republican primary, but in the general, that might have turned off some of the independents and undecideds. And
sure.
He doubled down on that after the Parkland shooting, the massacre at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. And he doubled down on that, did not recant. That did not help. His office, the Agricultural Department, also grants permits for concealed weapons. And it was disclosed that that office failed to do its due diligence in granting these permits, and hundreds of applications just kind of fell through the cracks and got their permits.
Nancy Ankrum, I want to play a couple of clips. That was sort of the table setting for what happened on Tuesday evening. Then a day after winning the Republican nomination, Congressman DeSantis really sparked a controversy, even a firestorm, with his comments about his Democratic opponent, Andrew Gillum. Gillum, it should be noted, is African American. Here's what DeSantis had to say the day after his primary victory over on Fox News.
The last thing we need to do is to monkey this up by trying to embrace a socialist agenda with huge tax increases and bankrupting the state.
Those were remarks that ultimately Fox News anchor who had hosted that show said that the Fox disassociated itself with because they seemed to be the backdrop was they seemed to be racially charged. Fox's Shep Smith asked Gillum to respond to what DeSantis said, and particularly the use of the phrase monkey this up. Here's what Gillum had to say.
Was that racist or a figment of speech?
Well, in the handbook of Donald Trump, they no longer do whistle calls. They're now using full bullhorns.
And that was a bullhorn?
And what I've got to say about that is that we've got to make sure that we stay focused, I think, on the issues that confront everyday people. I'm not going to get down in the gutter with DeSantis and Trump. There's enough of that going on.
So, Nancy Ankrum, down there in South Florida where you live and work, and for that matter up in the Florida Panhandle, how are these remarks playing out? Is it see as though that's shaping the people's impressions of the candidates in any way?
Oh, absolutely. And it's playing out as you expect. People who loathe this administration and the Trump clones and the Trump acolytes are saying, of course he kicks it off with this historically racist epithet to describe his black opponent. And on the other side, there are the true believers, the supporters of Trump, and again, his acolytes are saying, No, 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 that's not what was meant. That's not what was meant. Look it up. To monkey around with something means to kind of tinker and screw it up and things like that. So,
with racial overtones or at least a racial heritage there. Let me do this. I want to get in Kimberly Atkins to talk a little bit what happened in the couple minutes we have before the end of the segment about what happened in Arizona. You're having a wide open race to replace retiring Republican Senator Jeff Flake, who had decided he couldn't win the nomination again because of his opposition at times to President Trump. What do you make of what happened in those two primaries there?
Yeah, it seems that primary for the Republicans was a bit of a sigh of relief. The winner, Congresswoman Martha McSally, beat out Kelly Ward and Joe Arpaio, two people who are a lot closer, more closely aligned with Donald Trump, but who Republicans feared would really be at a greater risk of losing that seat in a general election against Kristen Cimina, the Democrat in that race. And so it was sort of a sigh of relief. The president himself did technically throw his support behind McSally, but McSally was someone who was a lot more critical of him during his campaign after those Access Hollywood tapes came out. But there's a real worry that Arizona could be a state that turns blue, if not in November, then down the line. Of course, now there is another open seat that there'll have to be eventually a special election for with the passing of John McCain. So it's a crucial state for Republicans. So far, they think that they've got the best shot of holding on to it now.
And we have a cut here of Arizona Republican Senate nominee Martha McSally on Tuesday evening after her victory, drawing a contrast with the Democratic nominee Kyrsten Sinema.
Between a career fighter pilot and a career politician, between proven grit and Hollywood glitz. Now, there's nothing wrong with Hollywood glitz, right? Look, I am as impressed as anyone that my opponent brags that she owns over 100 pairs of shoes. I, on the other hand, have over 100 combat missions serving our country.
She's a choice Republicans are happy about. Kyrsten Sinema, her opponent, has her own stirring story to tell of an upbringing that involved living for a number of years at in what had been an abandoned gas station that may have been without running water. Kimberly, Jack, and Nancy, please stick around. We're talking about the week in news. We'd like you to stick around, too, and we'd like you to join our conversation. How are you remembering John McCain? What do you make of the Hurricane Maria death toll now on par with 9/11 in Puerto Rico? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is the new On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik, and we're looking at the week in the news. You can join the conversation. How will White House counsel Don McGahn's departure affect the Mueller investigation of the president and those around him? What about Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's record ahead of his Senate confirmation hearing? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Miami Herald editorial page editor Nancy Ankrum, Boston Herald chief Washington correspondent Kimberly Atkins, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. First, I do want to take a couple of calls. Folks have been calling in. I wanted to go to a call from Banner Elk, North Carolina. Dylan is online. Thanks for listening, Dylan. What you hearing? What you thinking about?
Hi, David. I just wanted to say I think it's pretty intellectually dishonest to label what Ron DeSantos said as racist. I mean, that's
a
phrase people use all the time. First of all, he used the word monkey as a verb, not even as a noun. And it was, and no, if he said we better not monkey this up by electing a black man, that would obviously be racist. But he said, we better not monkey this up by voting for socialist policies. There's a big distinction there. Yeah.
I'm sorry, Dylan. Let me just ask you a quick question. There does seem to be, from a number of folks who've researched this and who follow this, that there does, for better or for worse, and let's acknowledge it's for worse, seem to be certainly a racist origins of that phrase. Do you feel as though in the current times that somebody using it may not be tapping into that, even if it's about an African-American?
No. And if you do think that, I mean, let's hold everybody equally as accountable. Mm-hmm. The Daily Wire has an article that shows 8 videos of prominent Democrats, everybody from Joe Biden to Barack Obama, using the same phrase.
Using the phrase monkeying around or monkeying up?
Both.
Okay. Well, Dylan, I appreciate your call. Thank you for your input on that. We also have a call from Enid, Oklahoma. Teresa is online. Teresa, what are your thoughts?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am.
I really feel like there is a mainstream media spin against progressive candidates because they want to do public purpose funding from the federal government, just like FDR and Eisenhower did. They want to call it socialist. Socialism has to do with taking over the total means of production. And as far as the economy, I do not think that you all are in touch with what is going on below the top 20 to 30%. We are carrying the economy on our backs in the form of credit debt. Our economy is in the toilet. It is not doing good at all.
Teresa, thank you for offering that. Obviously, you're hearing Teresa tap into thinking that people have thought on the right and the left in terms of their concerns about Washington. We're also thinking a little bit about Washington today and this week with the service for Senator John McCain. Kimberly Atkins, as we think back on how his career has been evaluated and appreciated and what we've heard in recent days, what's the tenor like in Washington now?
Yeah, you know, in the service in Arizona, it went out to the tune My Way by Frank Sinatra. And I think that was a really key and appropriate sentiment. Everyone, people from across the aisle, people from all kinds of different industries and in different areas of the senator's life really came forward to paint a picture of somebody who was unabashedly himself, who stood up to his own principles, even when it went against his own party or went against some of his allies, who was very funny and who had a very wry sense of humor and really painted a picture of someone who was an American hero for sure, but also a real human and someone who they looked up to as a great example of an American.
Jack Beatty, you know, where does McCain stand? How do we evaluate him? How much has he affected our history, and how much has he been – has there been hagiography this week and sort of perhaps papering over the blemishes that even at times McCain himself was the first to admit?
Yes, but if this be hagiography, let's have more of it. It's it's great to hear Senator McCain get his due. This Senator McCain ended his recent memoir, his last book, and the last page of the book, the last thing he wrote, is a lyric of Robert Louis Stevenson's called Requiem. Under the wide and starry sky, dig the grave and let me lie. Glad did I live and gladly die, and I laid me down with a will. This be the verse you grave for me. Here he lies where he longed to be. Home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter, home from the hill.
You know, he could certainly identify the lyric moments that can tap a lot in us all. We've got folks who are calling in, actually, to talk a little bit about that. I can see, Dolores is there calling from Waterford, Pennsylvania. She has thoughts on John McCain as well.
Hi, David. This is difficult for me. You know, we're witnessing the country honoring this great man. I mean, he's one of the last statesmen, if not the only statesman we have left. I know who would be the first to tell you that he was imperfect, but he was a man of integrity, honor, empathy, dignity, who was, you know, championed human rights and who had an unwavering love for this country. You know, it was country over party. Yet what we have this sick element that's claiming that the QAnon, that claims that he's been in prison now in Gitmo because he was a traitor. But having said that, I believe that as a nation, we need to decide when we come to that fork in the road, whether we're going to travel down the path of John McCain or we're going to travel down the path of Donald Trump. And I hope for the sanctity and the salvation of this nation that we travel down the path of that honorable man, John McCain.
Thank you so much, Dolores. Thank you for that. I'm not sure that we're going to be sending, at least on public radio's authority, anybody to Gitmo anytime soon. Appreciate that. I did want to highlight another story that played out this week at that event that didn't occur this week, but I think it's really worth remarking. The official death toll of Hurricane Maria was increased to 2,975. That is roughly equivalent to the number of people who perished during 9/11. It is an astonishing tally and far greater than what had been told to the public as the official tally of 64. A day after that was announced, President Trump claimed this week that the U.S. government did a fantastic job responding to the disaster. On Tuesday, the mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico, Carmen Yulín Cruz, criticized President Trump for his comment, telling MSNBC that, in fact, the federal government's response to the disaster was wholly inadequate.
Here, the president just today and the White House yesterday just recant their self-accolades about how well they did. It just means that he just doesn't get it. He's incapable of getting it. We died because bureaucracy and inefficiency took a hold of things. We died because many in the political class in Puerto Rico decided to dance Donald Trump's tune rather than doing what everybody ought to do, which is tell the truth.
Nancy Ankrum, you're down there in Miami, Florida, a place that has to deal with hurricanes all too often. You know, from your vantage point and from what you hear from your readers, your audience, many of whom have relatives in Puerto Rico, some of whom may have even come to the mainland from Puerto Rico in the wake of the hurricane. What do you hear about how well that was handled versus how adeptly previous administrations and previous governments have handled earlier hurricanes?
Well, clearly there was a breakdown in how the federal government did intervene, did come in to help with the cleanup. You know, you can compare it more to, I think, to, say, Hurricane Harvey that had happened earlier in the year. There really did seem to be quite a hesitation, even a neglect of the true needs there. I will say this also. Puerto Rico fell down on the job in terms of preparedness. Mm-hmm. Those many thousands of extra people who died were living in poverty, were living without the resources to protect themselves, were living without the resources to really enact preventive measures for themselves. There was a high level of poverty there that resulted in these deaths, in these extra deaths. And I think Puerto Rico also, in the run-up to this, was neglectful.
Kimberly Atkins, in Washington, you know, Republicans obviously control both the executive branch and Congress. To what degree is this seen as a federal responsibility? What we've just heard from Nancy, the idea that actually, you know, this is a problem with leadership in the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, and that this is not wholly a question of the immediate response. Where do responsibilities lie and where do government officials see their role as being in such things?
Yeah, I mean, I think that without question, there is obviously responsibility to go around. But if you look at the response and spearheaded by the president of the United States in terms of leading the messaging, it seemed pretty clear since the immediate aftermath of that storm that he was very concerned with comparing it to past storms, comparing it to Katrina and saying what a better job that that he had been doing. Clearly, if these new numbers indicate that that is not the case, there was clear differences at the time in the response to Puerto Rico as compared to responses in, for example, Texas or Florida after storms suffered there. That was blamed in part to the fact that Puerto Rico is an island and it had a much it had an infrastructure in much poorer shape to begin with. All those things might be true, but that is also in itself plenty of blame to go around for that as well. It's really hard to escape just given the attitude that the president has expressed toward Puerto Rico compared to other places that Puerto Ricans were treated in a large sense as second-class Americans in this. And I think that's the biggest problem moving forward in addition to the response from FEMA that is going to be under, you know, taken a look at and there will be analysis done of that. But I think at the end of the day, this seemed more like a crisis of the way, in terms of the way Puerto Rico was prioritized as opposed to necessarily
compared against Houston, compared against other places.
Exactly.
Chuck Beatty, let's talk a little bit about the White House itself. Their departure was announced this week by President Trump of his chief White House counsel, Don McCann. That, of course, was done by Twitter, because why not? That's how we do it in this day and age. What does it say to you that the president's counsel is leaving, call it, I don't know, 20 months into his term at a time of clear legal peril for the president, for those around him, possibly for his family?
Well, I think Alan Dershowitz was pretty cogent on this. He made the point that given
to be clear, this is the retired Harvard law professor and sometime Trump advisor.
Yes, that given the I think 30 hours of testimony of answering questions from the Mueller inquest, it would be very awkward indeed to have the White House counsel effectively testifying against the president. So that once that happened, and of course the Trump people had no idea that McCann was talking this much, or if at all. But once that happened, it was just only a question of time, it seems to me, before Mr. McCann would have to leave. But you know, this week, let's just turn the camera slightly. The pulse of the Trump administration mostly is a kind of saga of falsehood and fantasy, incompetence mitigated by moments of ignominy. And two came this week. One was the whole farce, the degrading business of not honoring John McCain. You know, the AmVets, the national director of AmVets, put it this way: it's outrageous that the White House would mark American hero John McCain's death with a two-sentence tweet making no mention of his heroic and inspiring life. And, of course, the flag was up and down.
Sure.
Mr. Trump officially is within a pound of being obese. He's a big man, and yet he's among the smallest occupants of that office we've ever had. But the second moment of shame was his comment to the ministers at a evangelical ministers at a White House function, threatening that if the Democrats win the election, there will be violence. This is a
right. Well, let's take a moment there, because that's actually, you know, obviously much more substantive than the president's weight. This is something where it seems to me that it's let's throw that to Kimberly Atkins for a moment. The president, it's evangelical ministers, is saying there is the threat of violence if my party doesn't prevail. He's talking to people who theoretically are not supposed to be purely partisan figures. He's also making very ominous claims about the consequences of not supporting him, as opposed to arguing for a case. How was that taken in Washington?
Yeah, you know, the president, a couple things that have been consistent with Donald Trump since his campaign is the use of violent themes, violent rhetoric in talking about things, even when he's talking with, religious leaders, and the use of fear. I mean, everything, and particularly his immigration policies, when he talked about the Muslim ban or the need for the wall in on the southern border because of rapists and criminals. It's this idea that someone's going to come get you, someone is going to do violence if they are on the other side. And it seems to be the go-to rhetoric that he goes to when there are crucial things at stake, like the upcoming midterm elections. And that's where he turned. I mean, clearly there, I have not in my reporting seen any evidence that there will be some sort of violent governmental overthrow. But that is the theme that he likes to put forward. He likes to see himself, see others around him as attacking him down to the point of physically.
Kimberly, we don't have a ton
of time. Can I add to that?
Yeah, briefly.
I just wanted to say he was talking, of course, to his true believers, and he understands that they will take this message back to their pulpits.
Mm-hmm. How do you see, and very briefly indeed, do you see this being embraced down there in Florida by federal candidates?
I do not. Some will. I think most will not. I think it was an eye-rolling comment.
An eye-rolling comment from the president. Usually it's a treat-rolling content that we see there. But nonetheless, we'd like you to stick around, all of you, our guests Nancy, Kim, and Jack, but particularly you, our listeners. We're discussing this week's biggest news stories. We want you to join the conversation. Will President Trump strike a trade deal with Canada? What about his latest attacks on the press, or perhaps more pressingly, on the social media, of which he makes such effective and frequent use? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is The New On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes. Set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent. In other news this week, Neil Simon, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, author, and screenwriter, died Sunday at the age of 91. A child of the Depression who turned to the movies to escape a sad home life, he got his start writing for Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows with his older brother Danny. Think of the comedy firepower around that table, including Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, Larry Gelbart, the creator of MASH, and a very young Woody Allen. And Simon proved as influential a figure. Throughout his six-decade career, he wrote plays and screenplays that plumbed humor not just for laugh lines, though there were plenty of those, but insights about life as it was lived. Neil Simon hit his prime before I was old enough to appreciate him. But just think of all those hits on Broadway and the movies. The Odd Couple, The Out-of-Towners, Barefoot in the Park, Brighton Beach Memoirs. The accolades followed. Emmys, Tonys, a Pulitzer, Kennedy Center Honors. A career that culminated with the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor in 2006. We have this brief remembrance, starting with Simon speaking to NPR's Fresh Air in 1996.
I don't think that the mind differentiates about what's going on in real life or what's going on in the fiction you're writing.
Everything you do irritates me. You leave me little notes on my pillow. I told you 158 times I cannot stand little notes on my pillow. We are all out of cornflakes, F you. Took me 3 hours to figure out that F.U. was Felix Unger.
We don't surrender. You hear that, New York? We don't quit. Now, how do you like that? You go ahead and you can rob me and starve me and break my teeth and my wife's ankles. I'm not leaving.
Paul, if the honeymoon doesn't work out, let's not get divorced. Let's kill each other.
Let's have one of the maids do it. I hear the service here is wonderful.
It's been very rewarding for me. I don't think I would like to have been anything else in life but a writer, but I also don't think I could have been anything else.
We gave full hours to the lives and legacies of John McCain and Aretha Franklin earlier this week. What other stories in the news grabbed your attention, or do you think were overlooked? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's take a call from Dayton, Ohio, to set us on our merry way. Kathleen is calling. Kathleen, there was an issue that sparked your interest this week. Tell me about it.
Well, several issues, of course, but I grew up in a hardcore Union family, and my World War II Teamster father, William R. Galt, started saying, he died 4 years ago, he was ready to go, he started saying back in the 70s that both parties had sold the American worker down the pike through these trade agreements. And so it's interesting, and he was a diehard Dem. And then I also want to talk, I watched Mayor Gillum's interview with my 90-year-old mother when Lawrence O'Donnell interviewed him this week. Mm-hmm. And I love my mother's perspective. She said he was measured and clear and concrete, and that he reminded her of Franklin Roosevelt, which she says about Bernie Sanders as well. And then I also want to say that Senator McCain, I honor his willingness to reach across the aisle. However, what he taught me, and I think he really taught all of us, is to fight like hell for what you believe in, even if it's in direct opposition to his stance on Vietnam and Iraq and giving rich people.
But the idea of being fight like hell for what you believe in. Kathleen from Dayton, Ohio, thank you for the multi-generational perspective, I should say. We're talking with Kimberly Atkins of the Boston Herald, Nancy Ankrum of the Miami Herald, and On Point Zone, of course, Jack Beatty, all here as well. I do want to talk about that issue that Kathleen brought up about trade. Trump was, from the outset, Trump has made clear that he'd be somehow going after Mexico and the Mexicans, although it seemed to sort of strike a deal that did relatively modest things around the margins with Mexico. Then he had some pretty tough words for our friends up north. Here's what he had to say during Thursday night's rally in Indiana. President Trump touted not only the talks with Mexico, but also talked a little bit about Canada. It sounded as though some of the frost was melting a little bit in that direction.
After the deal was made with Mexico, Canada came along, and they're negotiating right now at the White House, at our territory. And it could happen. We'll see what happens. And if it doesn't happen, we'll put tariffs on the cars coming in from Canada, and that'll be even better. So.
Then, interestingly, on Thursday, Bloomberg News posted and published an interview with the president in the Oval Office. And the president was even starker. He threatened to pull out of the World Trade Organization, sort of a multinational body that resolves trade disputes, if it doesn't treat the U.S. better.
I would say the WTO was the single worst trade deal ever made. And if they don't shape up, I would withdraw from the WTO.
Kim Atkins, there in Washington, as we are to think of all this talk about trade and some of this tough talk about trade, what are we to make of the president? Is he delivering on promises? Is this a lot of saber rattling? What are we to take from all this?
Well, a couple things. This idea that there is a trade imbalance and that it is not fair is something that Donald Trump has believed for decades. This is not something new. This is not just campaign rhetoric that he is repeating. This is a firm belief. But according to, economists that I talk to, it also represents a fundamental misunderstanding of what the trade deficit is and what causes it. He sees it as other countries treating the United States unfairly, doing something to the United States to take advantage of us, when the trade deficit is really based on the economy and the spending and saving habits of Americans versus those in other countries. Americans tend to save less and spend more at times of more prosperous times, like now when the economy is doing well, which means there's a greater demand for foreign products compared to people in Asia who tend to save a lot more and don't have that kind of responsibility. So the way that he is trying to solve this problem through tariffs isn't the reason what's causing the problem. What that actually does is cost U.S. consumers more in the long run, also disincentivize foreign companies from investing here, manufacturing here. That makes means fewer jobs for Americans. It actually can hurt Americans more than actually solve this problem, which isn't even caused by too low tariffs in the first place.
Kim, just quickly, let me ask you. He says that about the WTO. Do lawmakers, in the famous phrase, take him seriously but not literally, or do they actually think, oh, wow, we could be pulling the plug on that thing?
I think it's unclear now. I mean, this is something that has been reported for a while, even though the president denied it until he finally came out and said it. There are a lot of things that the president threatens and does not follow through on, but there are other things that he does follow through on. He did pull out of TPP. He did put lob hundreds of billions of dollars in tariffs against China, and is now threatening to pull out of NAFTA. So I think we'll have to wait and see what happens here.
I want to take a call from Bodenham, Maine. I hope I'm getting it right. Lisa is on the line. Lisa, what's on your mind?
Hi, David. I'm calling because I have serious concerns about the Brett Kavanaugh nomination from the standpoint of the civil rights of adults with disabilities. I am the mother of an adult daughter with disabilities who, if we can't work out some kind of a plan after my husband and I die, she might very well end up in state guardianship. And Kavanaugh ruled in 2007 that adults in D.C. who are under state guardianship do not have a right to be consulted or even talked to about elective procedures that are done on them, medical procedures. And it's disturbing that that's his default position. People with disabilities who qualify for guardianship there's a huge range of people who are from completely nonverbal and noncommunicative to people like my daughter who qualify for guardianship. But you can absolutely have a conversation with her, and absolutely she can be made to understand what's happening to her medically.
And Judge Kavanaugh's rulings has been in your mind very difficult for a lot of people with disabilities. That is that you see a harm to him being able to sit on the nation's highest court.
Absolutely, and it's because of his default position that they don't even deserve to be talked to. It's a real dehumanizing of people with disabilities, and it's something that was true not that long ago in state institutions that were closed. The main institution was called Pineland. It was closed, coincidentally, the year my daughter was born, and they have a long history, like many state institutions, of forced sterilization and pulling the teeth of people who live there because it makes them easier to care for, or just like these horrific things.
Right. And obviously, importantly, this country has taken strides, but it's often been state by state and often been affected very much from rulings. Lisa, an important issue to bring to our attention. Thank you for that. Jack Beatty, what do you see about the prospects of Judge Kavanaugh? Have they improved in recent weeks since his proposed nomination was revealed, or have they been affected in any way by the political and legal environments that we find ourselves currently in?
Well, I think it's a foregone conclusion. He will be confirmed. I mean, there's just been no doubt about that all along. But what a moving testimony we just heard from Lisa. Who would have thought there was a dimension of mean-spiritedness that would go there? Who would have thought you could extend some, view of judicial non-interference or whatever the conservative doctrine of the day might be? Who would have thought it could go as far as to say, let's not even consult the people we want to put into these snake pits, let's just throw them in as if it's 1930. My God, it's a new frontier in mean-spiritedness.
All right. I want to now take the news has broken from our journalistic colleagues to the north. The Toronto Star, Daniel Dale, has broken a story as we are in middle of this broadcast about the high-stakes trade negotiations between the U.S. and Canada. The newspaper obtained remarks that were intended to be off the records between President Trump and Bloomberg News reporters, in which he says, apparently, according to the Star's reporting, that he is not making any compromises at all in talks with Canada, but he cannot say this publicly because, quote, it's going to be so insulting, they're not going to be able to make a deal. Now, interestingly, the foreign minister of Canada had seemingly given body language and remarks suggesting that things were continuing apace yesterday, but he had said, according to another remark that Trump said he didn't want published, that the deal with Canada would be totally on our terms. This apparently has upended things in Ottawa, the capital of Canada, as well as talks there. Kim Atkins, how in keeping is this with the way in which Trump operates? Is he boasting there, or is it? Do you think he actually is going to give Canada a deal they can't possibly accept?
I mean, I think it's impossible to know. I mean, Donald Trump's deal making throughout his whole life has been in part, you know, puffery and a lot of tough talk before any sort of actual deal making can take place. So I think it's tough to say. It's interesting that comment. I mean, that it was off the record. It sounds like something that he would have said on the record too. So you know, it doesn't seem very much out of character. And I think that the Canadians on the other side of this negotiation are fully aware of the type of negotiator that Donald Trump is. So I'm not sure that this will move the needle one way or the other. But at the end of the day, Donald Trump is looking to get some sort of deal done while the Mexican President Peña Nieto is still in office. And if they don't get it done soon, that could put even the Mexican trade deal in place if it falls into a subsequent administration there. So he's kind of up against the wall. Perhaps he's trying to push Canada to move a little faster, but we'll see if it works.
And we'll see if it actually was something he was really proposing. Nancy Ankrum, you know, the president this week not only assailed a lot of members of the press this week and a lot of news outlets. He went after Carl Bernstein of CNN. He went after Lester Holt of NBC. It almost felt as though you could count who he wasn't attacking. But he also really went after social media platforms. And he claimed that Google was submerging things. He made the not only unproven but disproven claim that somehow Google had tried to submerge a video of his own State of the Union address earlier this year, or I guess in 2017 when he actually didn't give one. He gave an inaugural address. And he's made claims also that they're very hostile to conservatives, claims that have gotten a lot of play but not a lot of proof on such outlets as Fox News. What do you make of the president doing that? Do you think conservatives have a point when they make such claims?
I think conservatives do have a point when they make such claims, and I think that media outlets countrywide or nationwide are paying more attention to conservative voices. I think they have to make the distinction between conservative voices and those that go so rogue that they buy into and they promulgate lies and unsubstantiated claims such as the president makes. His criticism of social media, which he has used to great effect, actually, is in keeping, though, with his barrage of complaints and criticisms of media in general and free speech and the First Amendment. And so this is not a surprise.
And do you think it's going to get any – you've seen Kevin McCarthy, but briefly, are you seeing it, you know, on the congressional race level or anything like that getting traction, or is this really just something playing out at the top level with the president and the man who perhaps seeks to replace Paul Ryan as speaker?
I think that it will get traction among some candidates who are tearing a page from his page book. Ron DeSantis seems to be the – I know that's not a congressional race.
Yeah, the gubernatorial candidate.
Right, the gubernatorial candidate, though, you know, is joined at the hip with President Trump.
So those who are supporting that the president may do that. Nancy Ankrum, that's the editorial page editor of the Miami Herald. Thanks so much for joining us here on Point.
Thank you.
Kimberly Atkins, Washington bureau chief of Boston Herald. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Have a great long weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point's produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Kyrie Thompson, and Miriam Wasser. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. In the honor of late John McCain, we close the hour with Eternal Father, Strong to Save, the Naval Hymn. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.